Other Medicaid expenses of $28 million plus $18 million one time, distributed by the Qualifying Federal Government, and inflationary increases.
I think I should get a
start. We've got several legal issues that we're going to have to settle. Of that $14 million one time, the pet health settlement, Navajo Nation, is about 13 and a half of that. You've got the UHP crosses issue settlement that's part of that, and we'll probably have a few other issues that pop in there. We anticipate about $53 million for building maintenance, another $37 million employee benefit increase. A 1% WPU increase is $23 million. So depending where you dial a WPU, you can do the math at 1% increments. $23 million, 2%, 46, so forth. And then the speaker talked about debt. And we're concerned about our debt load. I'll get to that in a minute. But if we throw in a number of about $85 million one time to bring us down to where we feel a little more comfortable, start adding those numbers up, what do you see off the top? Anybody quick at math? The ongoing column adds up to $302 million, which right there, just with that list of requests and nothing else, already exceeds the $280 million that we have forecasted. If you add up the one-time column, that adds up to $161 million, which you can see clearly exceeds the $128 million we have forecasted. And so you can start seeing how requests for funding increases quickly exceed any revenue that we're forecasting. Any questions at that point? Okay, next slide. Speaker alluded to the reserve balances or the rainy day funds. We had upwards of $1 billion, and you can see we drained those significantly. The new balances for the general fund, $122 million, education fund, $110 million, disaster recovery is about $12 million. One of the other rainy day funds that we refer to is our highway funding. As a state, we like to put ongoing revenue into one-time projects and transportation because when the economy turns down, it makes it easy for us to claw that back into other activities. So that's one of our other pseudo rainy day funds that we have, and we've drained that significantly. Next slide. This puts in a picture what the speaker was talking about in terms of our debt limit. The top line, the blue line, is our constitutional debt limit. And you can see since that's tied to valuation of property in the state, you've seen that decline over the last few years. And you see a slow growth coming out of it. That's the new normal in the economy. The second line down, the red line, is the 85% of the constitutional debt limit. And so we, as a rule of thumb, want to stay below that line. We use that as a trip point to tell us when we're getting too close to the constitutional limit. Now you can see the black line has crossed over. And so right now our cumulative debt load is more than the 85% limit that we've set as a trip point. And that's one of the concerns. Because even if we sit where we're at and don't issue new debt and property values continue to drop, we're going to narrow that gap and we're going to potentially run into problems with that constitutional obligation that we have. The other concern that I have is when you have excessive debt, it limits your flexibility. And I have a concern that we're getting to the point where we're really tying our hands. If we should go into another downturn, we've got some serious problems there. Now, when I talk about a downturn, lots of folks talk about a seven-year cycle when it comes to the economy. Do the math. This downturn started in mid-2008, sort of 3.5 years into it. So we're 3.5 years from the next downturn. So, you know, that's one of the concerns I have in terms of the budget, that we don't get ourselves over a barrel because the next downturn, unfortunately, is coming quicker than we think. One of the other issues, next slide, Royce. We're seeing lots of issues in regards to volatility when it comes to revenue. Obviously, as the state economy grows, there's more revenue we're talking about. You can see this is just a chart that our fiscal analyst did last month. The very first bar shows sales tax volatility. Next one shows individual income tax. And the third one shows corporate. And this is kind of a chart that shows cumulative over the last 50 years. If you go to the next slide, you'll see kind of shown over time, this is sales tax volatility from 1935 to the present time. And you can see the increases in the magnitude of the swing of sales tax. Now, sales tax is more stable than income tax. So the next chart actually shows what we're seeing in terms of income tax. So one of those other issues that causes some concern is your forecasting revenues in the future. So that kind of wraps up what I have. Part of my job is to stay on time. So are there any questions? None at all? Wow. Okay, take out a piece of paper. We're going to have a quiz. Sorry. Have a great day. Thanks.
We are now going to turn to Senator Lyle Hilliard, who, as I mentioned earlier, is here by phone. Chase, I think, has that set up. Senator Hilliard, can you hear us?
I can hear you fine.
Perfect. You are live.
Thank you very much. I appreciated hearing Representative Dougal because he's outlined the basics very well. I thought I would just highlight a couple of issues as we face this session that I think everyone needs to be concerned about. First of all, I think Representative Dougal explained very well our concern about the debt limit and our constitutional bond limit. As our bond limit has come over that 85%, and obviously that gives us great concern because if we lose the flexibility of a major earthquake or something like that should occur. But there's another aspect of it that I think is really important. As you know, recently the United States government had their credit rating downgraded. And at the time they did that, we received a notice saying that all states with AAA bond ratings, which Utah has never lost, would be under jeopardy or under scrutiny as well because of the impact of the national. They picked five criteria they were going to look at. Three we had no problem with. Two we had concerns about. One is looking at federal payments into the state. I know we talked about how we get less federal money, but when you look at federal jobs, Hillfield in particular, we get a lot of federal money into the state through employment in that area. That is a concern because we have no control over that. We'd like to keep that going. We appreciate the income that Hillfield brings to us, but that's something beyond our control. But the thing that is within our control is how close we are to our bonding limit. And historically, we've been between 40 and 50% of the level on our bonding. We agreed to go up to 85% with the idea of constructing I-15 through basically Utah County and some of the Mountain View projects. And I think in hindsight that was a good decision because of how far we were able to go with construction at the time. But I'm really concerned that we now kind of have the attitude that 85% is our target, not our limit. And I think we need to be very careful that if there's another downgrade in the U.S. economy and they take a look at that, that bond limit could jeopardize our triple bond rating. And that could have a profound impact not only on the state but on school districts and others. And I think also we need to be very careful about bringing that bond level down to the 40 or 50% we've had before. You'll see in that schedule that that will happen naturally if we don't bond anymore. But I know there's going to be a lot of pressure on the legislature for higher ed buildings, capital facilities, and other areas. One of the major projects we built last year was at the State Mental Hospital. And those are the kinds of issues that come up, and we have to have some flexibility. The other thing I would point out is the rainy day fund. We're very pleased with that, and I remember when it got to $100 million, I thought, wow, we really covered any concern we ever have, and then we lost $1 billion, and then just wiped out our rainy day, or could have wiped out our rainy day fund totally so quickly. And I think the volatility that Representative Dougal has talked about is giving us concern that our rainy day fund should be put up higher. The 6% that we have for general fund, the 8% for rainy day funds, is probably too low, and we need to build that back up again to those levels and the volatility that he talked about. I think the main concern I have is, I've often jokingly said, the governor has two really good advantages that we don't have. First of all, he alone can make the recommendation. Representative Dougal and Representative Brown have to convince 38 House members. I have to, now I and Senator Van Tassel have to convince 15 Senate members to get a bill through. So the process is much more difficult in the Senate than from the governor's office to come up with a budget. While we work together, there's still compromises as you have to put that thing together. The second is most people have no idea what the governor's going through as he's putting his budget together. They don't know whether he's considered cutting here or changing here or doing that. They generally just see the finished product when he makes the announcement. We are pretty pretty open to the public, and we've tried for a number of years now to make our appropriations committees the meaningful area. So if you want a project funded or if you want an agency funded, don't come to me or don't come to Representative Dougal or Representative Brown to get it done. You have to go to your committees and make a presentation. And if you end up 40th on the presentation list and we get it funded down to 10, you're probably not going to get funded. So we have that open procedure. So when we have hearings and committees take votes to only fund one program, 50% of the request, and then everybody panics at the public, that's the process we go through, and we have to do it. We're out in the open in doing that. But I think it's healthy to let people know that we're not just rubber stamping the request of agencies. We're looking at tough decisions. And then we have the added advantage that we don't have to make our decision until the middle of February when we get our final revenue estimates. I'm nervous as I'm hearing people in the economy talk about what's happened since we got our figures to do our consensus revenue estimate. I'm concerned that we may have some more challenges. But on the other hand, Senator Van Tassel tells me that things are going really well out in the basin. So hopefully there's enough positives in the economy to offset whatever negatives we have. And hopefully we have this kind of money. It's going to be a welcome relief not to start the first session spending our first week trying to adjust the current budget, because we do have some surpluses that allow us to now concentrate on all 13 and also how best to spend the limited funds we have. I like the word invest in programs that will continue to keep the state on its AAA bond rating and be able to address the issues that we need and still have some empathy for the people who have to pay the taxes. And that's my summary. I'll be glad to respond to any questions.
Do we have any questions for either Representative Dougal or Senator Hilliard? Lively crowd. Thank you, Senator Hilliard.
I was going to say, it's a good thing it's not right after lunch. Nobody have any questions.
Well, thank you. We will see you next week, Senator Hilliard.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.
We're going to move to our next section of discussion. If you have copies of the agenda, you'll see that the next three items all look at some questions about what businesses the state should be in. As many of you know, the state owns several golf courses, and they have a lot of parks, which, as the state auditor general a year ago recommended, to say, are there some ways to find other ways to pay for those parks? We're going to hear some discussion. First from Senator Hinkins talking about state parks, and then from a couple of operators of golf courses and the options that they have been able to exercise throughout the country and here in Utah about private options that may be available for that. So, Senator Hinkins, if you could join me.
Thank you, and I'm Senator David Hinkins. I serve as co-chair of the Appropriations for Natural Resources and Agriculture and DEQ. I was charged as a committee, as our committee, we had an audit that was performed on the performance of the state parks a few years back, and so the recommendations that we're going to talk about is some of the things that came out of that audit. Last year, by the way, our budget is $28 million. We have been asked to have it. It was about $12 million about 2 or 3 years ago that was from general appropriations from the general fund. We've been asked to have that down to $4 million by the year of 2015. And so our committee had some intent language that we give to the state parks last year, and I'll run over them real quickly. We recommend that the Natural Resource, Agriculture, Environmental Quality Appropriations Subcommittee adopt budgetary intent language specifically for the general fund appropriations to be reduced. We recommend that the division monitor revenues and expenditures of each state park and report the resulting profit or loss annually to the legislature. We recommend that the division find and implement ways to reward park managers for improving their park financial performance. We recommend that the division develop a business plan for each state park. Such plans, which should be updated annually, should include strategies for maximizing revenues and minimizing expenditures. We recommend that the division prepare a careful analysis of potential returns on investment for each proposed capital investment. The analysis should be evaluated by the department's finance director before any proposed capital investments is approved. We recommend that the division consider using a lower cost staffing methodology that encourages the use of seasonal employees. We recommend that the division examine the overlap of support staff positions at different levels in the organization and determine whether some positions should be eliminated. We recommend that the division evaluate the feasibility of the following options for reducing the cost of law enforcement personnel. A, reduce the number of law enforcement positions. Employ limited status officers with compliance authority only. Create a separate entity responsible for law enforcement, perhaps at the department level, and reduce retirement benefits for the new officers. We recommend that the division evaluate the management needs of each park and region and consolidate management positions where feasible. We recommend that the division continue to modify the hours and days of operation of the parks to control costs. We recommend that the division identify parks where seasonal reductions make a good business sense for the state. We recommend that the legislature consider closing some of the state's high-cost parks with low visitation or transferring the oversight of those parks to a county or local governments. We recommend that if the legislature decides to privatize some state parks, they direct the division of the parks and recreation to submit them to a privatization implementation structure, which would include a list of parks that could be successfully privatized, along with recommendations for a pilot program. The current revenues and costs of the parks to be privatized and expected savings to the state, drafted requests for proposal for review, and plans to maintain continued oversight to ensure that the contract terms are met and the quality of parks are maintained. One of the things that came out in the audit was the golf courses. We have 4 golf courses in Utah. We have, I think, 42 state parks, some of them heritage parks. We have $4 million that we really can't do much with because we're obligated to the heritage park. Some of the heritage parks won $800,000 to This Is the Place park. And one of the alternatives is if we were to cut that funding, that's one of the alternatives, they'd give the park back to us, and we don't want that. So it's quite costly to have, and so we're appreciative of those that runs that park for us. And so we're actually getting by pretty reasonably by with the $800,000 that we get to help manage that park, because it is a real benefit to the state. Our charge is to look out for the taxpayers' dollars, and by that we expect to have recreation in Utah. I mean, that's why most people live in Utah, is because of the outdoor recreation. So our intent as a committee is not to close any parks, but to try to make them as streamlined and as effective and as efficient as possible. We're looking at other alternatives. I went last year down to Arizona, where they had a great presentation by Warren Meyer. He's the president of RRM, and a lot of the parks in federal government's done this with their state, their federal parks for the last, I would say, 20 years or better. Strawberry Reservoir is actually by concessionaires, and I believe it's American Land and Leisure. Steve Ward manages that, and most people wouldn't even know that happens. I mean, most of the parks, there's over 1,000 parks in the western United States that are managed by concessionaires that are state parks and federal parks in the west, and most of the people coming to wouldn't even know the difference, because the way it's ran is kind of we're not actually turning the parks over to private, and that's been one of the problems that we get from a lot of people that I've got letters from, that's we're not actually turning the parks over to individuals to make a profit off the state things. Basically, they're concessionaires, and they can do it more efficiently in some cases, not always, but we've got a test. The state parks is running a test right now down at Otter Creek with a concessionaire, and We're waiting to see. A lot of this hasn't been tried because a lot of the, in fact, even from the parks, basically said they didn't have a lot of cost. I mean, we've actually implemented it. It says we believe that we add more profitability to the state and maintain customer expectations for access facilities and public safety with our private business partnership model. We're experimenting with this model and the cost accounting system, which will help us analyze the business success of these various opportunities. Our goal is to maximize profit and community benefits while keeping the quality and cost and access at the level that people, patrons enjoy and expect. With our partners, we have created local jobs, new businesses, and activities in the communities. While we are moving ahead on several privatization options, Otter Creek Green River Golf Course and Flight Park, refining our business partnership models and working to increase the business elements to state parks. It's premature to create a list of parks for privatization because we don't know the entire profitability picture without cost accounting. That's one of the things that this audit has done is it's made the parks more accountable. They didn't have a great cost accounting for each park, and so now they've really done a great job. I really got to compliment the state parks for the they have responded to all these requests that we had, and they're really striving to make things better, and so we know where we're at on our budget, and they really have cut a lot of costs down. They've really done their best. So I'm going to turn some time over now to Billy Casper Golf, and so sure. That's what we're trying to do is look at all of the alternatives.
Thank you, Senator. Why don't we have Billy, if you guys want to come up. I don't. You've got a couple of folks here. I don't know who's going to do the speaking, but I'll be here running your presentation.
That would be great. We'll get this queued up. Can anyone hear me when I'm standing up here? Good. Thank you. Good morning. My name is Douglas White. I'm the Vice President with Billy Casper Golf. And with me today is Mike Cutler, who's our another Vice President with Billy Casper Golf, and Mr. Dan Parkinson, who's a citizen in the state of Utah, and a special guest, Mr. Billy Casper himself. Billy? Billy's kind of an adopted son. Billy in the early 70s came here for nearly more than a decade. His playing career took him back to California, but when Billy, next slide please, when Billy won all these wonderful accolades, guess where he came back to? The state of Utah. So we're glad to have him here, and certainly it's a pleasure to be here. We thank you very much. I will tell you this, Billy's very clear with us about our company. The senator was very forthright about maintaining quality, maintaining what we do for the constituents of the state. And that's quality, that's service, and that's attention. Billy is very directive. The name of our company is Billy Casper Golf for a reason. He holds a high level of integrity, and the service he gives his fans is uncompromised. We hold that same. So as it relates to park services and quality, we hold those standards very high, a lot because of that gentleman sitting right here. Next slide. I want to take you real quick to what's happening in our industry. You're looking at a lot of statistics here, so I'm going to be very, very brief. We are seeing a double-digit percent decline in rounds played. In an 18-hole equivalent of 35,000 rounds, we're now down to 31,000. That's over a 10% decline. What's happening in our industry? Next slide, please. The most important thing about our industry is look at the number of lost golfers. 4.6 million of 26 million people are lost golfers. Our issue is as much about gaining golfers, but it's more about retaining golfers. How do we retain golfers? In our park systems, it's price, it's quality, it's service. And that's for the company such as ours. Billy, it's been since 1989 since you gave us the pleasure of using your name to run our organization. When we move into cities like Chicago and states of Illinois, we are there for the long term. We're a company of over 23 plus years with 130 golf courses. We're very sustainable. What we are focused on is retaining the golfer. Next slide, please. This is the gap between gained golfers, the gained golfers being the blue line, the lost golfers being the red line. That gap is not sustainable for our industry at all. And we're seeing this across states, cities, all municipalities. Next slide, please. I don't have to go through the challenges that municipalities and states have. There's limited money, from $280 million to $300 million in expenditures. The parks is a part of that, an essential part of that. It is no longer acceptable to take taxpayer dollars to subsidize services, whether it's parks, golf courses, or anything else. That's the paradigm shift that's in our industry right now. Next slide, please. So what are your options? Your options are full service management contract, an operating lease, or a concession agreement. And the Senator spoke very well about the concession agreements. Next slide, please. Let's go through the myths and the realities. Privatization is a term that many people are not aware of and that many have some concerns about. So with that, go ahead. The myth is that the rates are going to increase. Well, under a management structure, the state controls the rates. The committees control the rates. There is no rate increase. It's dictated by market and approved by the municipality. Next. Residents lose access. Reality is locals are the number one priority. In any golf course, state park, play from locals can be 65% of your play, 70% of your play. Who gets access? Conditions deteriorate. Not at all. Improved conditions equals more golfers. Increases our retainage, increases our growth. Next. Loss of jobs. That's the number one mandate in many municipalities, is preservation of jobs. We have an organization in our HR department of 14 to 15 people that focus on recruiting and retaining good people. We're always looking for good people. Service suffers. You'll see our initiatives in customer service. And we have a platform that's dictated or focused on really enhancing that service experience. Next slide. So, the advantages of a management contract. A national operator in scale of 130 golf courses can buy a lot less than single operators. We can bring expertise in every discipline, from the accountability to every piece of the operation, at a cost that cannot be incurred by the municipality. But the risk and reward, the reward is that you retain control. The term can be as short as 3 to 10 years. The most important thing about a management agreement is you're not giving taxpayer dollars to a private entity. You're retaining all the profits. The management company is responsible for driving the additional income. And of course, the municipality has to focus on the capital improvements to sustain their assets. The operating risk, of course, is the fact that the municipality is at risk for operating losses. Here's a real example in Chicago. We can focus, you know, we've talked about the bond rating. We were actually successful in Chicago in helping to maintain and improve their bond rating. So, you know, the Chicago Park District operates many concessions throughout Chicago. Next slide. You can see here there was another private operator, a regional, local private operator. You can see the difference in red to blue from the amount of rounds on a 6 to 8 hole portfolio to the revenue that was driven. And much of that was about retainage, customer service, driving loyalty. Next. Here, the management agreement, again, growing profitability. Indian Springs outside of New Jersey, we flipped the line from red to blue. That was over a 3 to 4 year period. The lease is probably some of the most problematic in terms of the taxpayers' concerns. Their sensibility is that we're giving a private operator all of our taxpayer dollars. That is, in fact, true. The concession or the terms of the lease agreement can be such that there is a share of profitability. Our lease structure is that we share over and above a certain threshold. So there's some ideas to make that lease so it's not as concerning with the taxpayers. Oftentimes the lease is beyond 10 years and you lose a lot of control. So from the management perspective to the lease perspective, you can see the difference. The most concern for a municipality is trying to unwind a lease. What we see we operate 70 municipal contracts. What we see is a lot of private regional operators that take over a concession operation, are not well capitalized. And what happens is the cost to unwind that for the municipality to get back to where it was is rather expensive. Here's another one in Jacksonville, Florida, city of Jacksonville. Next slide. This is under a lease agreement concession where we share revenues. You can see a growth again from 2004 from 35,000 rounds. I won't go through all the particulars, but you can see there's a lot of growth and a lot of reward. Next slide. Orchard Valley in Chicago, this is part of what we were discussing in terms of the what a lease agreement can offer the taxpayers, the benefit. Next slide. This is a concession agreement in Chicago. The most important thing about this is we will be in Chicago for about the now our 12th year, so it's sustainable. And you can see the consistent growth that's going on. Next slide. We operate in 26 different states. We will play almost 5 million rounds of golf. And if you look back at the statistics, you saw we play 24 million annually. We play about 5 million rounds of golf in our portfolio. The most important thing is 2 million of those people, we can tell you how many times they play our golf course. That's real statistics that helps us grow in terms of loyalty and driving revenue for our constituents. I hope that was informative. Some of this stuff about the industry, the options that are available to municipalities, to states, with the whole directive is to conserve taxpayer dollars and to drive as much as we can in terms of benefit to the taxpayers. With that, Billy? Maybe Billy wants to say a few things and I'll take any questions you have.
Well, I'm just... they're the candles and the icing on the cake, and I'm the plate that just holds it there. I appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning. I've never had an experience like this before, being in front of such wonderful people that are dedicated to the service of their fellow man. I only congratulate you for it and wish that you can keep up with the same work that you're doing now and just make our lives much better. It's great to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Bailey. Questions?
Do you have any questions?
Yeah. Yes, sir.
A tangential question. There's talk about eliminating daylight savings time in the state of Utah. How is that going to impact the number of rounds of golf?
Very interesting question. The most important thing about driving rounds of golf is the ability of the operator to schedule in peak and non-peak times. So the accountability that the Senator spoke about is the ability to drive rounds into compact times. There's a lot of way to move golfers around golf courses, and you have to have somebody that has that creativity to be able to do that to take on the challenge you're talking about.
But if you eliminate that last hour of summer evening, how many rounds of golf are you going to lose?
You would be amazed. If somebody does a capacity report that the senator directs, you may find that your golf course is playing at 50 to 55% of capacity. So that would tell you that there's more capacity available on that golf course. And that's what we look at from a yield management standpoint is the capacity utilization, which would answer that question. I don't know what your capacity percentage is right now.
I think we have time for one more question before we go to Mark Wetzel. Pat?
You talked about the three options municipalities have in dealing with you. Which do you prefer and which do you see the most of in your operations with municipalities?
Real quick, and I'll ask it very succinct. Is the lease option is where you give up all the control, but you may take on a capital partner. And you really have to be careful about what that is. Most municipalities kind of in the structure where you are in a state would look at the management agreement. Because remember, you retain all the profitability. You approve the business plan. And that makes the most sense for a state, you know, what we know today, that would be the option that makes the most sense. The concession agreement is you're taking on somebody just to lease out portions of the actual operation. So that's really the difference.
Which do you do most of?
Of the 70-some-odd municipal golf courses we have, nearly 50% of them are lease. But those are long-term sustainable leases.
I'm thrilled that we have a lot of other questions I saw, but we're not going to be able to take that. I do hope that we'll have conversations that will continue on the side. As indicated earlier, there's a wide variety of providers in this. You've got Billy Casper, which is one of the largest in the world. We've also got Mark Wetzel from Vanguard Golf, who is a local provider. He operates the golf course out in my hometown in Eagle Mountain. We wanted to hear Mark's comments as well.
Thank you.
Thanks, Royce.
Thank you.
It's great to be here, especially with Billy Casper. We say that he's our adopted son to Utah, but I think I'm Billy's actual adopted son. So I love Billy and got a great friendship, and they run an absolute class act at Billy Casper Golf, and they manage and lease and a lot of golf courses around the world. Really, to go back to some statistics, we definitely have been hit by the economic industry. An interesting statistic by the National Golf Foundation that Billy Casper alluded to is since 1990, demand has only increased by about 5%, while supply has increased by 60%. We all don't need to be math majors to put that together. So having a privatization of golf courses and really capitalizing on the economy of scales is imperative. As far as bulk buying, as far as marketing, advertising, customer service, everything that goes along with a privatization is extremely important. Really, right now in our industry, just like everybody else, we're making sure that we're getting the customers and we're keeping the customers. We feel very positive about our track record and what we're doing as management and operators, that we can have a solution for the states and municipalities to try to turn a profit. It's not a magic wand or a magic bullet. There's a lot of hard work. But I'll tell you what, with the economy of scales and the buying power that we have, we can definitely make a dent versus just having it state ran. I do want to dispel a couple of myths. Number one is we don't go into courses and pillage, as a lot of people think. We go in for a year or two, take all the profits, then take off. We're there for the long haul. As Billy Casper Golf Management mentioned, we like to do long-term management deals of, you know, 3 to 10 years. Personally, we prefer 10. From a local standpoint, currently our golf courses are in Utah. We have two in Salt Lake City, primarily Thanksgiving Point, the ranches in Eagle Mountain, as Royce was mentioning. We have two in southern Utah, Coral Canyon, and also Sky Mountain, which is a municipality. And then we also manage one in Nevada, in Mesquite, Nevada, Falcon Ridge. So we're definitely a homegrown, local golf management company that can bring a lot of sustainability to the state parks and a lot of know-how, just because we basically rule the market. What I mean by that is that we rule the marketing, advertising, everything that goes on from partnerships to KSL, from UNA Golf, to the type of facilities that we offer. With that being said, in an RFP, if that goes that way, it's very important to make sure in the RFP that you have a quality management company, whether it's a local operator like ourselves or Billy Casper, that has the experience of not only managing golf courses, leasing golf courses, and also owning golf courses. And as a couple of those questions came out, our preference is we like to lease and we like to own. We did a deal with Eagle Mountain City, which was a lease to own at the ranches 3 years ago. And we took that course from about 12,000 rounds to 24,000 rounds in 3 years. And we're now going to be owning that property here this the year sometime. So our preference is more of a lease to own and have that accountability of, hey, if we don't make it, guess where it comes out? It comes out of our pocket, not from the state or the municipality. So I really feel it's imperative that when you do an RFP, that there's some accountability towards the management company, and more importantly, you select a management company that has experience like us or Billy Casper Golf. That's really all I have. Any questions or
thank you, Mark.
Comments?
Royce, is there any questions?
I remember back, and I've been kind of following this privatization of golf courses for many years, Utah has got probably one of the higher percentages of public-owned golf courses.
Correct.
In the United States, so it should be fertile ground. Have you tried municipalities and counties to give a chance to hear your story?
It really is, and the great thing about Utah is we have some phenomenal golf courses that are city-owned and state-owned. The price of green fee is well below the national average, but yes, it's definitely fertile ground, and it's time to start to look at the privatization and look at the options that are out there and utilize the economy of scales that we offer as management companies.
And most of them are being subsidized by the taxpayers.
That's correct. That's correct. You're very welcome. Thanks, Roy.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Our next discussion is one that has been in the headlines throughout the year, and I think will likely continue to be a hot issue during the session. It also touches on some of the privatization themes that we've been discussing for the last few minutes. We've got Representative Ryan Wilcox to talk about where he sees things going with the ABC.
Good to be with you here today. I admit it is extremely odd to be speaking at this mic from this side of the table. I don't know if anybody's noted that yet. But hopefully we can get this up and get it going. This is admittedly, well, several years of work in less than 10 minutes. So I apologize. It's going to be somewhat high-level overview. But I have fun with the title this morning. You might like that. Misdirection, Utah, the DABC, and alcohol control. If you can go to the next one there for me, Ms. White. Thank you. I mean, Rose. Thank you. Yeah. Why? And, you know, several years ago, I sat as an intern at the Utah House of Representatives. Actually, I had several, but that was 2008. And was sitting in some of our committee meetings and for the first time realized that the state had a retail presence. I suppose I'd always seen the bars on the small buildings and thought them to be somewhat of an oddity in my community. They looked more like jail cells than anything else. As I was elected in the legislature the next year, because of my retail background, I was placed in the committee that oversaw the ABC. Within the first couple of months, I'm pouring through reports, much like I would in my regular business. And a few months in, I had this sudden realization that I was in the liquor business. It's the last thing I expected to be doing as an elected official was contributing to the sale of liquor. One, personally, I don't drink. It makes me uncomfortable. I don't believe in it. I am a member of a religion that specifically teaches not to drink alcohol. So from that perspective, it made me uncomfortable. Second, we also forced every other Utahn into the industry. Royce. I understand why we did this. So that got me into studying the history, how we got involved in it in the first place. There are several reasons that make sense for there to be a strong control policy in the state of Utah now. Primary concerns, overconsumption, DUI rates, alcohol-related crime and abuse, teen and youth drinking. As we see, we've had fairly regular debates, including that year I was an intern with the AlcoPops issue about alcohol policy in Utah. Go ahead. Some of the problems that we face have had to do with the fact that we do or we don't measure things in the right way. For example, DUI rates are tossed around quite a bit as an indicator of how successful we are in controlling alcohol in the state of Utah. Utah does have a low DUI rate. In fact, it's gone down. That's good news. The difference is the comparison between Utah's rate going down and other states is contingent upon those who are drinking. The percentage of the population that actually drinks is dramatically lower in Utah than in other states. When you compare that comparison of those who actually drink to compare it to our DUI rates and other indicators, we're not doing that well. In fact, our numbers are masked by that percentage. We're not measuring the right things. We don't necessarily know where people are getting drunk. What's causing the DUIs that we do have? Which proprietors aren't being responsible with overconsumption? Where are teens getting drunk? Two cases in the last year alone in American Fork, which is the only place that we've really looked at in detail lately, of suicides directly related to teen drinking. How are they getting it? Most of the time it's from irresponsible adults. If we need to adjust our policy, it needs to be based on things that we can actually measure, things that we can trace back to where that policy is impacted. Right now, we don't know because we don't know how we're doing because in most cases, we're not measuring the right metrics. Go ahead. As you know, there have been 12 legislative audits in the last 2 years at the ABC. I copied and pasted a couple of my favorite headlines. Incompetently managed, culture of corruption spanning decades, widespread mismanagement. We brought this out in the spring. We brought it out in the form of a first step, that being the idea of converting our state liquor stores, the ones that were not already package agencies, which is about half, into the package agency model, theoretically allowing the state and the agency the control function, about worrying about control instead of retail. This was prior to the most damning reports, the most damning audits. What we saw was a structural problem with the division charged with control of alcohol and selling as much liquor as possible for the kids. That was my favorite part of the committees. In fact, it's in this room. So the ABC will come in and brag to us about how much money we make that we can turn into Parents Empowered, that we can turn into these other agencies. Those programs are great. I don't necessarily want an agency selling as much booze as they possibly can so that they can make more money for the state. If we're going to be a controlled agency, we need to be focused on control. That's, in my opinion, that's the singular purpose of having the agency in the first place. Auditor cited years of bid rigging, falsifying financial documentation, artificially splitting invoices in violation of state statute, as well as other inappropriate, potentially illegal business dealings. So we know there have been felonies that have been discussed. Part of the problem is that some have chosen to see this as just a problem with the last few directors of the agency. The last audit released in October showed that that was a culture of corruption spanning decades, back 30 years. When you have an agency that is charged with control, but doesn't have the accountability measures in place to ensure that the other side doesn't take over, that selling as much liquor as possible for the public good doesn't go somewhere else, one of those two is going to win. One of those two sides is going to gain the loyalty of those in charge. Go ahead. The Department of Alcoholic Beverage Control should be just that. Not a wholesaler, not a retailer. I understand that may take some time. We have some history here in the state of running it a certain way. What I'm proposing isn't that we throw the, what's that phrase? The
baby out
with the bathwater. Thank you. You knew exactly what I was thinking. Baby out with the bathwater. But that we look at it with fresh eyes. We take a look at this problem for what it is. That we start measuring the things that actually impact the policy. Tradition is great. But if it doesn't lead us to reduce teen drinking, to reduce DUIs, to reduce alcohol abuse, and the family consequences of that, the societal consequences of that, then we need to reconsider our actions and maybe our direction in policy. So part of what we're proposing right now is that we take even the smallest of baby steps in that direction. That we take a look at how we align our policy with the outcomes that we all agree that we want. Part of that is including new measurement standards. One of the things that we can talk about in this short amount of time quickly is that our police departments, for example, right now collect a lot of this data already, but they don't talk to each other. They use eight different standards, eight different systems, and they don't communicate. We have one county in Salt Lake who's invested in a system that's working. If we can get our other police departments to start communicating with a similar system, we can start collecting the data to understand if the policy decisions we're making are actually impacting the metrics that we care about. Then we'll start to improve the system in Utah. But our policy has to be tied to results. We get the best results with a clear mission, a structure that reinforces that mission, clear oversight and accountability. I look forward to the discussion that we'll have this session. There's several that are interested in it. I know there's been a lot of work done on the Senate side as well. The governor's office is very interested. And we have continually throughout the year invited those who are interested to speak with us. But it's a complicated issue, and there won't be a simple solution. But as we move toward this idea of focusing on what we're good at and basing the decisions that we make on the metrics that we actually care about, then we'll be headed in the right direction. Thank you. Oh, hang on. There may be one amazing slide left, but it looks like we missed it.
Do you have any questions for Representative Wilcox? Good, because we're behind, so thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
In Utah, alcohol is obviously a hot topic, but in the West, as everyone knows, water is about as difficult a topic as there gets. People may get upset about a lot of things, but Water probably is the most valuable commodity in this state. Senator John Valentine is going to be talking about that. We've got proposals out there asking for billions of dollars to build new pipelines for water. And we want to talk about what the right way to pay for water is and how that may change our long-term usage and needs. Senator Valentine.
I can tell you today that I am very glad to be here talking about water and not about booze. As the guy who got identified as Mr. Liquor by Doug Wright a couple of months ago, I'm really glad to be able to do that. When I started my legislative career in 1988, one of the major issues we had was water. I looked back at the history of this state and saw that water was indeed one of the major issues of the formation of the state. I look at the wars that occurred with even the dominant religion, and where they had various different types of debates and discouragement of using the civil system to try to resolve it. And many times water was resolved at the hands of a shovel or the hands of a shotgun. And it was not one of those things that was very clear in our early history of how we allocate water. We develop a system of allocation of water in Utah based upon prior beneficial use. And that prior beneficial use then became the hallmark of how we allocate water. But we did not develop a system to decide how we pay for that water. Payment for the water in Utah is many times masked. It is hidden. The true cost of building the projects, the delivery systems, and the scarce resource itself is masked by most jurisdictions paying for it by property tax. When I first looked at that issue, when I was still in the House of Representatives, it was clear to me that the issue of the cost of water was intentionally to be masked, to be hidden. As a person who really likes to see transparency and really likes to see us having a full cost understanding, I really wanted to try to come up with some solutions. So I've been working on and off on this problem for a number of years, trying to figure out a way to deal with it. The problem is this. On one side, we have made our jurisdictions who decide that they cannot build water projects just on rates because it's not a predictable source. I keep having that told back to me. On the other side of the argument, they say, but it's a predictable source for us to be able to generate our operations. And so I get a kind of a dysfunction. I get kind of a disconnection between the real cost of operations and the real cost of building and financing projects. The proposal that I have this session is a bill. It is not yet fully drafted. The proposal is this: to phase out over a 5-year period the ability to use property tax to finance water projects. Water projects should be done with rates. It will increase the cost of water rates, but it will not increase the cost of water. Because what it will do is it will have people understand what the true cost of the water is. Now, the devil is in the details on any type of proposal such as this. The devil in the details is some of our rural areas probably cannot afford to build projects without property tax, especially when we have so much of our property still locked up by the federal government. So we have to be able to be responsive to some of our rural needs. We also have the large, my party elephant, or another party, another moniker, in the room that tries to decide how we allocate water, and that's the CUP. And so many times as we deal with issues such as this that are such monumental importance to Utahns, we have to do some things that will be dealing with those particular types of entities. I don't know yet all the details on how it will be worked out, but I'm convinced that we need to move forward to the idea of paying for water for its use, its true cost, rather than having it hidden by property taxes. I'm willing to take any questions, and again, we're a little short on details right now because we're still in the process of working it all out. I can give you the details if you wanted to. Yes.
How might this affect the project for the dam on Bear River that's coming in the next 30 years?
The one that has been coming on forever?
Uh-huh.
When I first got up here, we were talking about the Honeyville Dam, and then we finally decided the Honeyville Dam would not work, and then we tried another location and decided it would not work. That would be a project that you really ought to pay for with water rates. You really ought to have a payment that occurs so you recognize what the cost is. Water is a scarce resource. You have to allocate it by some way. Right now, we hide the allocation, and we use it as though it were not scarce. And so that's one of the things that I really feel like we really need to focus on. If that project's going to go, it'll have a 5-year window. If it's not going to go, then it'll have to be financed by water rates. Other questions? Yes, Mark.
Is it across the board to all users?
That's where I'd like to end up. Now, am I going to start there? I'm a realist. Sometimes I have to make compromises to get to where I want to get. But I think it should be. I think it should be ag, it should be M&I, it should be the full set of users. Yes?
Why should the legislature tell communities how to price their services?
The legislature has a responsibility to deal with the natural resources of the state. In this case, the natural resource is water. The city may, quote, own the water because it has developed a beneficial use and has acquired water, but it's still a natural resource, and it's still something that the state has a very vital interest in trying to allocate that scarce resource. It's like saying, well, the air above a city should be our responsibility. No, it's not. It's a scarce resource. And so that's why we engage in this type of a discussion. We engage in the discussion because we believe that that resource needs to be allocated based upon those who are using it. They should pay for it. Any final questions? Yes.
How does this, or will it extend to any of the water districts who already levy tax within their taxing district? There's not much transparency when it comes to their budgets behind those levies.
Now, many of those are special service districts or water conservancy districts. And you're correct, there is not a whole lot of transparency. But I am also a realist. I realize that we cannot make bonds go into default. So indebtedness that is incurred prior to the effective date of the Act has to be recognized and has to not go into default. So there is going to be a transition period if the bill passes. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Unsurprisingly, water brings a lot of questions. We're going to be moving things around on our agenda a little bit. We've got folks in transit, and actually Representative Dougal had to run to another meeting, so we will probably catch some of the time up that we're behind right there. And we're going to next turn to Chris Blake, who is the head of the Charter School Association, to talk about a proposal that the Charter School Association is looking for that would create a way for charter schools to bond and help build their buildings. Chris.
Somebody going to run?
I guess.
Yeah. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. I want to thank Senator Stevenson and Royce for the opportunity. We'll hit our point here quickly. Obviously, education is critical to everything that we're doing in this state. Businesses, taxpayers have recognized the importance of making sure that we have a fantastic education system, and I appreciate the support that you have offered. Just briefly, so you know, charter schools in the state of Utah have grown at a very rapid rate over the last 10, 12 years since the law was implemented in the late 90s. Currently have 81 charter schools, 45,000 students. That will increase to up over 50,000 next year. If you were to lump all the charter schools into one group, that would make them the fifth largest district this year, and next year it would be the fourth largest district. And overwhelmingly, new students that are coming into the system are choosing charter schools throughout this state, and they are becoming proving that innovation, doing a number of different things. They're also becoming more focused on traditionally disadvantaged students. Carolyn Charette's here in the audience has opened two new schools on the West Valley City area, School for New Americans, and the Accelerated School. One of those schools has a particular focus on refugee students, helping train them and bring them up to the level. So some of the innovation and things that are going on in charter schools are really exciting and providing a great opportunity, and hopefully providing a level of competition for everyone to increase the level of learning and academic outcomes at all of our schools. Okay, so I'll get to the third slide here, Royce. One of the big stumbling blocks or issues that charter schools still have is around facilities. This is an issue that is a nationwide problem. Facilities are critical to the educational outcome, the way that schools teach their curriculum. And as charter schools go to the market to bond, they are paying a much higher interest rate than a traditional district school is paying currently. The big reason for that is there is a constitutional guarantee here in the state of Utah that allows district schools to take advantage of the state's full faith and credit, its AAA credit rating and obligation. So in the current environment, they might be paying 3.5, 4% interest rates when they go to bond and build their buildings. Charter schools, under the best case scenario, despite the fact that they're taxpayer funded and have the same obligations in terms of financial reporting and accountability, are paying in the current environment 7, 7.5, maybe even 8 percentage points when they go to market. That gap, as you can imagine, is literally hundreds of thousands of dollars each year that is leaving our schools, leaving our state, and ending up in some high-yield bond fund. In addition, I'll just mention that renovating existing structures, sort of the original ideas of charter schools, you know, maybe in a shopping mall or taking advantage of a vacant building, the building codes have become, the school building codes have become so difficult that they're really not able to do that. So we put them in a catch-22 where we're saying, you know, we want you to start your school, test your experiment, but we're not going to allow you to renovate a building. You need to build your new facility. And at the same time, making this huge discrepancy between what a taxpayer-funded building is having to pay in interest rates and taking hundreds of thousands of dollars out of the charter school and sending it away. As you'll see in this next slide, you know, we're sending it back to the East Coast. And I believe strongly the dollars that the state spends and already are at a premium for our students. As we send that out of the state and don't keep it in the classroom, that's a disadvantage for all of our kids. So we've been working with the state treasurer, Richard Ellis, go ahead and flip here to the next slide, and Senator John Valentine, Representative Derek Brown, bond attorneys from Chapman and Cutler, Ballard Spahr, some underwriters, some of our charter school folks, to create a program that will remedy some of this imbalance for charter schools, a charter school credit enhancement. What we're attempting to do is create a moral obligation similar to what the state offers institutions of higher education, the housing office, student loans, a moral obligation that will allow charter schools to go into the market and get a better rate when they go to build their buildings. Typically, a moral obligation results in a credit rating one notch below the entity that's backing it. So the state of Utah has maintained its AAA credit rating, one of only six states to do so. So our hope is that a moral obligation would result in a AA rating for charter schools. That spread between that AA and where they're at now is once again, $150,000 to $200,000 a year that the charter school can keep here in the state of Utah. In addition to that moral obligation, we would obviously want to make sure that our charter schools, those that are able to qualify, have a strong track record of financial success, so that they will need to be investment grade rated. Typically, there are many charter schools, and many here even in the state of Utah, that have been able to get that investment grade rating as they've gone through the underwriting process. That same hurdle will continue today. What we've seen throughout the United States in the last 20 years that charter schools have existed, no charter school has failed when it has had an investment grade rating. Think about that. Well, it's only 20 years, not a huge track record of length of time, but certainly in the last 20 years, we've probably had two of the greatest stress testing events with the bubble in the early 2000s and these last couple of years. So what we've seen is schools that are able to get that investment grade rating are financially viable, and that's what the hurdle will be to make sure that that we don't create any additional problems for the state of Utah. And then finally, we will create a funding component at the state of Utah, a credit debt reserve fund, for lack of a better word, that the schools will deposit a small amount into that will serve as an insurance pool, a liability in case there ever were to be a problem. So in addition to shrinking, you know, let's say they're refinancing from a 7.5 to a 4.5 rate, for example, they might bond at a 4.75, kick that additional quarter into the state's debt reserve fund to create insurance and make sure that if there was a problem, there's a way to remedy that. In addition, just so that you know, there's two other mechanisms that are currently in place that have proven very successful for charter schools. One is bonding covenants always require the school to have a 12-month debt reserve fund at the school level in case there were ever to be a problem. And in addition to that, there's an intercept program. So the money that the state sends to the school, instead of it going to the school and then to the bondholders, it is sent to a trustee who pays those bondholders, and then the remaining dollars are sent to the school. So we have a program in place currently and with this that will ensure that we are protecting our bondholders, protecting the state and its credit rating, and allowing the schools to keep more of their dollars in the classroom where it belongs and where we should be keeping it. Here you'll just notice the anticipated savings that would come from this program. That's $150 to $250 per year for every $10 million in debt, plus savings in transaction fees, and hopefully more buyers, not only nationwide buyers, but hopefully more buyers here in the state will see that AA credit debt as something that they'd like to bring into their portfolios, their pension funds, and expand and increase that pool, which over time obviously has the added benefit of pushing those rates down even lower. So that's where we're at. I appreciate those that have worked hard on this, spent a great deal of time. I'll mention that the greatest thing about this program, particularly in these times of difficult dollars, we're looking at doing this program. This is a way the state can leverage its credit rating on behalf of the charter schools, keep dollars in the classroom without appropriating additional ongoing dollars. So it's kind of a win-win for everyone. Doesn't create that budget problem, but does create a savings at the school. With that, be happy to answer any questions on that and appreciate your time.
Trying to straighten this out in my mind, with regular schools, the district is the responsible entity when they bond for buildings. With charter schools, apparently, is the charter school organization itself that's the responsible entity?
Yeah, absolutely. And I probably should have mentioned just briefly how charter schools are organized. Charter schools, the group that goes and gets a charter is a governing board set up as a 501c3 nonprofit. But they and have certain governmental responsibilities, including open meetings, public records, and financial reporting requirements. But this board that governs the school is the nonprofit is responsible. Is the entity that goes out to bond currently for their schools and do that. So it's set up that way, and they receive their charter from the state.
Okay, so the only connection between the charter school and the school district is the WPU funding mechanism follows the student to the charter school as well as the government school.
And these are public schools. Both district schools and charter schools, public schools funded by taxpayer dollars. The WPU, the student amount essentially that is done at the state level, we equalize our income tax dollars and send that out on a per pupil basis. So regardless of whether they go to district school or a charter school, if it's a student, that similar amount follows them to that school of their choice. In a few minutes, you'll have another presentation talking about one area of discrepancy, but if a student goes to public school A, the dollars follow them there. The income tax dollars follow them there. They go to public school B, whether that's charter or district, the income tax dollars follow them there.
Supplies in the classroom cost is included in the WPU.
All of those operations are what they have to manage their entire operations by. Yes.
Maybe I was asleep, but what is the context of the moral obligation that says to the market, give us this at a lower rate. If that's not the bonded indebtedness, not an obligation of the state to pay it if it defaults, what's the moral obligation be?
Did you want to hit that one, Steve?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry. It's a conduit bond. Utah County issued 9 conduit bonds for charter schools in Utah County because nobody else would. And they got the county's AA-plus rating on each one of those, though the county was not liable. But the morality is it's our children, and we should provide them the same opportunity in a charter school as in a public school because they are a public school.
And David, moral obligation, much like we do with the institutions of higher education, I mean, you're right. The state is not obligated, like a full faith and credit, can't go and get a judgment levy to raise the property tax like they could with a school district that has that full constitutional guarantee. So it's a moral obligation. So they.
No, no. So why find a bank that's going to loan you the money, or the bondholder who's going to pay them allow you to do it? Why do I drop the rate by 3%?
Because the state's standing behind it, saying if there's ever a problem, we're there. It's moral obligation behind, much like we do with higher ed. It is not, they're not required to. That's why it's a moral obligation. They're not legally contractually required. You're right. I mean, I think the state of Utah is going to stand behind those bonds, much like if the University of Utah was to say, you know what, we're done paying on the Eccles building. Best of luck. The state would have to decide, do we step up and back those bonds?